You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to the founders of a Buy Nothing group in Appleton, where members request things they need and give away things they no longer do. Now, President Biden signed an executive order last week that aims to add more protections for women seeking abortions following the overturn of Roe v. Wade by the Supreme Court.
I'm asking the Justice Department that, much like they did in the civil rights era, to do something, do everything in their power to protect these women seeking to invoke their rights. In states where clinics are still open, to protect them from intimidation, to protect the right of women to travel from state that prohibits seeking the medical attention that she needs to a state to provide that care.
The order focuses on medication abortion, emergency contraceptives, and patient privacy. It directs the Department of Health and Human Services to take up the charge. Abortion rights advocates and some Democrats say the order doesn't go far enough, and they're calling for the Biden administration to do more to protect reproductive rights. Opponents are accusing Biden of trying to circumvent the Supreme Court's ruling. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this executive order from the White House? Do you want the president to do more for abortion access, or should he leave it up to Congress and the states? If you work in reproductive health care, we'd love to hear from you. What are you seeing right now? What do you think people should know? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Claire McKinney is an assistant professor of government at the College of William and Mary. Her research focuses on gender, politics, and reproduction in the United States. Claire, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, could you tell us a bit more about what is in this executive order and what stands out to you as you looked at it?
Yeah, so the executive order has quite a bit in it that's worth noting. First is the Biden administration is trying to clarify health privacy protections, what HIPAA enforcement actually requires to limit the free flow of information of people who may be seeking abortion. It also provides technical and monetary assistance to healthcare providers to clarify and to help provide access to contraception, including emergency contraception, as well as putting funding towards a public education campaign to let people know what their reproductive rights are. In addition to that, in the clip that was played, the Biden administration made it very clear that they're also looking to protect the safety of clinics, which is a top priority right now as anti-abortion activists continually try and target these clinics for their own efforts. The final piece is that the executive order clarifies that for federal workers, their paid sick leave does include taking sick days to travel for any healthcare needs they may have, including those related to accessing abortion.
And in general, how much of a difference do you think this could make for people needing reproductive health services or abortions, particularly in places where they might now be illegal? Do you think this makes a big difference?
Unfortunately, I think it only tackles anything that's on the real margins. Take, for example, the HIPAA privacy protections. The executive order clarifies that it's only if there's a court order can a medical provider release somebody's medical records, including anything related to post-abortion care. That does mean that the medical professional can't just volunteer that information, but in states that are very determined to go after and to charge people with abortion-related crimes, it's not going to be much to stand in the way of it. So unfortunately, people who can't access abortion in the states that have the strictest laws will still be left without this option to control their reproductive health.
On that privacy front, this order also asks the Federal Trade Commission to explore privacy protections for data online and on period tracking apps, too. Can you tell us a bit more about some of the concerns there that it's trying to address?
One of the earliest social media points that came up post the leaking of the Dobbs draft was that period tracking apps could very well be subpoenaed by law enforcement officials and be used to demonstrate that somebody could be pregnant and then seek not to be pregnant. I think that some privacy experts have shown that privacy tracking is probably the least of the worries, because there's already widespread precedent to subpoena phone records, subpoena text messages, and any search engine queries that somebody has made. And so the FTC can, and I think, as you said, is empowered by this executive order to investigate these privacy protections. But as with anything dealing with law enforcement, whenever there are state crimes that are being investigated, there is a wide berth of leeway given to what it is that can be requested. Now, these internet service providers, sites like Google, can always turn down these requests, but those protracted legal battles speak to a whole other set of issues and the larger problem of a chilling effect of people being able to seek the care that they need will remain.
The order also asks the Department of Health and Human Services to identify ways to protect access to medical abortions, abortion pills, so-called. Could you talk about how those have been regulated differently than surgical abortions and why they have kind of fallen outside of the scope of the Supreme Court's decision?
Medication abortions are controlled largely by a decision made by the Food and Drug Administration about 20 years ago when they found that mifepristone is safe for use as part of producing an abortion. And so the Biden administration and Merrick Garland, in particular, even before this executive order, made it very clear that medication abortions could not be banned totally from the state because states cannot override FDA authority. That's been true for the past 22 years. But what we've seen in practice is when states like Texas have passed laws that ban the use of medication for abortion after 7 weeks, there hasn't really been any effort on the part of the federal government or the Justice Department to contest the legality of those laws. So the push here to investigate whether or not medication abortions could still be available for people in states that have the most severe restrictions is showing one path forward, but one that may be very limited, given that a physician may be very reticent to prescribe medication abortion in these states with the most severe restrictions.
We're talking with Claire McKinney right now, an assistant professor of government at the College of William and Mary, about the White House's executive order aiming to protect some access to reproductive health services after the Supreme Court's decision overturning Roe v. Wade. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Let's go to a caller now. Jack is with us in Madison. Hi, Jack.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up, Jack?
Yeah, you know, I was just going to say that on the whole, there's a lot I don't know about the process for women to obtain access to the healthcare and the services they need. But I will just say that someone's, you know, trying to get an abortion, they're pregnant, like they have the right, I believe, to do whatever it takes to, you know, safely and ethically get that abortion. And so, you know, that being said, there's, again, a lot I don't know about how to obtain such a procedure. And so I guess my question is, what is the Biden administration doing that will have the best short-term effects, if you will, you know, in light of Roe being overturned and given what the president and his administration can do to increase women's access to abortion, again, in light of the quagmire that we now have with Roe v. Wade having been overturned.
Gotcha. Jack, thanks for the call. Claire, to Jack's point of short-term solutions for women seeking abortion access, what are you seeing out there?
I think that the Biden administration is really hamstrung in what they could do to provide practical access for people who live in states that are determined to eliminate access to abortion. As Dobbs v. Jackson and the Supreme Court has made very clear, they think that abortion is an issue to be left to the states. And until there is federal legislation that preempts state law only at the very margins can there be any protection of access. And so I think that the two things that stand out to me in the executive order that provide the most kind of tangible in the moment points of access are this guarantee that federal workers can use their healthcare benefits to travel to states where abortion is legal, and that they are really pushing for money given to healthcare providers to expand access to emergency contraceptives. That isn't the same thing as an abortion, but contraceptive access is going to be even more important now that people cannot make the full range of choices concerning their reproductive health.
And one other aspect of this order is seeking to convene more pro bono legal representation for healthcare providers that might be charged with providing an abortion. Now, here in Wisconsin, Both the clinics that provided abortion services have ceased doing so because of an 1849 law that has been seen as going back in effect after the Supreme Court's ruling. Is that legal representation part of this order kind of symbolic, or are there parts of the country where this could be more contentious and put into use?
I think that we're going to see quite a bit of contention about what the post Roe v. Wade world actually looks like. And so I do think that it's notable that seeking to provide a guarantee or at least provide access to legal representation exists. If we look to what the political world looked like before Roe v. Wade, one of the things that really sparked public attention to the need to reform very restrictive abortion laws was the fact that physicians who were providing abortion that they thought was necessary medical care were being prosecuted. This happened in DC, this happened in California, and it was through the courage of particular physicians willing to say that this was necessary medical care that we got to see a sea change in how people viewed abortion. And we really see part of the movement for abortion rights taking off in that period, in part because of this alliance between physicians and lawyers who pushed for changes in the law and changes so that they could provide the care that they needed. That might be our future going forward. I think right now we're in an intense period where the uncertainty is actually leading to people being overly cautious. So hopefully this pro bono representation will encourage the same sort of courage that we saw in the 1960s.
We're talking with College of William & Mary Government Professor Claire McKinney about President Biden's executive order regarding reproductive health services last week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support the president taking some action through this executive order? What questions do you have about what it does and doesn't do? Are you concerned about privacy protections when it comes to people seeking reproductive health? Are there other ways you want to see the Biden administration address abortion access? What about Congress? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Claire McKinney. She's an assistant professor of government at the College of William & Mary, who researches abortion law and politics. She's with us today looking at President Biden's executive order on abortions and other pathways for federal reproductive rights. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Let's go next to Andrew in Eagle, Wisconsin. Hi, Andrew.
Hi there. I just had a quick question for your guest regarding where in the Constitution the so-called authority for the federal government to intervene in the abortion issue arises from, because looking at Article 1, Section 8, it lays out all the authority that Congress has, and abortion appears nowhere in there, nor does murder or anything else. And then you look at the 9th and 10th Amendments, and both of those amendments state that whatever is not mentioned within the Constitution is to be left up to the states and to the states alone.
Gotcha. Andrew, thanks for the call. And of course, the Supreme Court's decision returned control over abortion law to the states, but it's not exactly entirely clear that it's only a state issue. Claire, what are you seeing in terms of the boundaries between federal and state power?
So the original decision in Roe v. Wade found the protection to be found in privacy rights. So yes, we find that as articulated in Griswold v. Connecticut in what was called the penumbra, which means the kind of the shadow of the Bill of Rights, the Third Amendment, the Fourth and Fifth Amendment, the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, all find some notion of private liberty as something that is protected, even if it's not enumerated. Feminists have often called for seeing this in the 14th Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause, given the profound effects unwanted pregnancy have on the class status of women. Absent access to abortion, what we see is women, because of their gender and because of how their gender is associated with reproduction, is a way to condemn them to second-class citizenship. That notion of equality has been articulated in the early 1970s in a court case in Illinois that did not get taken up later on. There's also legal scholars who say that we might want to look to the 13th Amendment and the prohibition on forced labor. If we think about pregnancy as the forced gestation against one's will, that is labor that the body is doing. And so some have toyed with the idea of thinking about how refusing the body's forced labor in gestation and in pregnancy could be a site for articulating this. All that being said, the Dobbs decision said that there is no private liberty right to abortion, much as the caller suggested, and it said it dismissed very quickly any equal protection grounds. And so this is why many people are arguing for the need for Congress to codify the protections of abortion and to move around away from the kind of question of constitutional right.
And just to clarify, what congressional pathway does or doesn't exist to codify Roe? It would require eliminating the filibuster in the Senate. Is that correct? And what is the lay of the land with that prospect?
I think it would be near impossible to get any codification of Roe v. Wade. There was a bill, I believe it was titled the Women's Health Protection Act, that Chuck Schumer kind of put forward, and it was defeated. Both, you know, the fact that Manchin wouldn't sign on to the original bill means that there's not even a 50 vote threshold for the most basic protections of people's access to abortion. And so even the elimination of the filibuster, which the Biden administration has now said that it supports for issues around abortion, as well as the issue around voting rights, doesn't seem to get over the fact that there is not a majority of votes in the Senate to actually codify Roe at the moment.
And Claire, I know that you are very interested in the healthcare side of this question. Last time we spoke on the show, it was after the draft of this decision leaked. We were anticipating kind of a scramble to see where things fell, where states went in terms of what they would allow doctors to do or not to do. What are some of the open questions you see right now for healthcare providers across the country?
We see a lot of anecdotes of pharmacies refusing to fulfill prescriptions that include drugs that can serve as abortifacients, that is, drugs that can produce abortions if somebody is pregnant. So I think that the chilling effect that we're seeing practically is even worse than maybe some had intended. For the broader kind of healthcare landscape, we're really kind of struggling to see, and I think a lot of clinics are shutting down preemptively because of this. One thing that's notable is we did see the Whole Women's Health Care, which was at the center of a previous lawsuit that made its way to the Supreme Court, announced that they are going to shut down their clinics in Texas and move across the border to New Mexico. And so I think that we'll see more and more of these kind of border crossings as we continue to see the fallout of and the legal ramifications of the decision.
There's been calls from some progressive Democrats and reproductive rights advocates to say, hey, President Biden, do some more here, even going as far to say, use federal lands to establish abortion clinics and access. The White House has rejected that idea. But what are some of the other ideas on the table that you think the administration could explore or that you might expect to see in the coming months?
I think one of the issues that will be really pressing is protecting any right to interstate travel. I think it's going to be very difficult to get any short-term traction on ensuring access to abortion in the most restrictive states. And states like Missouri have already been toying with eliminating interstate travel as a right for anybody seeking an abortion. So I think on the federal level, this is certainly something that can be and regulated fairly easily. There's a lot of court precedent to say that the federal government does have jurisdiction when we're talking about interstate travel and interstate commerce.
Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin said after the Supreme Court's ruling that it was going to be shifting its attention to providing people with access and with resources to get appointments in other states. Is that similar to what you've seen around the country in states where abortion is now illegal?
Yes, I think the most established organizations are simultaneously trying to shield themselves from any legal action against them, as well as trying to serve as best they can, given those legal parameters. You see more kind of civil disobedient action coming from grassroots organizations that are seeking to provide direct access to medication abortion or surgical abortion through things like, you know, having ships in international waters and things like the Gulf of Mexico. So we're seeing really the tracks open wide for what's available if you're interested in providing access to abortion, even in the midst of the legal turmoil.
Well, we'll leave it there. Claire, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Claire McKinney is an assistant professor of government at the College of William and Mary, who researches gender, politics, and reproduction in America. She was with us today looking at the federal abortion protections and President Biden's executive order on reproductive rights this last week. You can still let us know what you're thinking about this by emailing ideas@WPR.org. Do you want to see more from the White House? Are you happy with the executive order from last week? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, a Supreme Court decision this month allowed a high school football coach to pray on the field with his team. We'll talk about what impact that could have on the separation of church and state in a school setting. Plus, community marching bands are out and about during the summertime. We'll talk with the city band director about their tradition, and you can shout out your local band. That's coming up tomorrow morning after 7 o'clock on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Last Friday, we listened back to a conversation with a UW-Milwaukee film professor about foreign language movies, and a lot of you called in with your own favorites. Get out your pen and paper. Joseph from Green Bay says The City of Lost Children, a French independent film, is really impressive. Jim in Cedarburg recommends the Russian war movie 72 Hours. Sarah in Madison says the French and Dutch film The Vanishing. I will second that, Sarah. That's a very creepy but a really good movie. Rob in Madison said Delicatessen from France is a beautiful dystopian film. And I will get in on the action myself with a couple I've seen recently. Ivan's Childhood, directed by Andrei Tarkovsky, and Knights of Cabiria from Federico Fellini. Not necessarily happy films, but really good ones. So thanks everyone for sharing those picks. Hopefully that'll get your next movie night off to a good start. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wisconsin woman tells us about her upcoming journey to be the youngest person to ever travel across the world on a motorcycle. First, the Buy Nothing Project is a movement that encourages people to rely on their neighbors for things they need and buy new things only as a last option. Members of Buy Nothing groups can gift things like clothes for their kids that they might have outgrown or services like helping with household chores. There are over 7,000 Buy Nothing groups around the world. Now, we're spending some time with the founders of one in Appleton to learn more about it. Sarah Scanlon is an environmental health specialist for the state of Wisconsin and helps start the Appleton Buy Nothing Facebook group. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And James Bacon is an educational technology business owner who serves on the Appleton School Board, also helps run the Buy Nothing Appleton group on Facebook. James, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having us. It's good to be here.
Sarah, I want to start with you. For people who are unfamiliar with Buy Nothing, can you explain a bit more about how it works?
Yeah, so members that are in our local community map. So each Buy Nothing group has its own map that you have to live in, and you can ask for or gift anything that's legal or within Facebook guidelines. So for example, I have asked recently for 2 adult bikes as a recent ask, and I've also given all kinds of herbs and things like that from my garden.
And James, I'm curious, how did you first encounter Buy Nothing and lead to getting it started in Appleton?
Yeah, so I lived in Boston, Massachusetts before moving to Appleton back in 2019. And the group in my neighborhood there was really active. And just honestly, especially after having a young kid, found that it was really great as a way to get to know people and also get all the things needed for being new parents without the pressure of spending money and worrying if the kid didn't want to use it. And then slowly it just started to really, or I guess I started to realize how great it was for any and everything. And so when I moved here, I looked for one and there weren't any. And when I went through training to start one, I met Sarah, and that's how we kind of got to know each other and started the group here in Appleton on the north side of town.
I think there's a tendency, maybe especially among people here in Wisconsin, to be reluctant to ask for things. I certainly count myself in that camp. It might be a little awkward to say, hey, I need this. Can someone just give it to me free of charge? Sarah, could you talk about sort of coaching people and how to ask for things?
Absolutely. So in our early days of Buy Nothing, James and I practiced asking for things a lot, actually, because we found that you're right, that oftentimes people struggled with that. It's kind of like a culture shift for them. You know, it feels weird, feels awkward. So we demonstrated it a lot. So our posts often will start off with the word ask. And then, you know, sometimes people will give a little story about why they need this item or want this item, because it doesn't have to be a need. It can be anything. You can ask for anything. And we found that if we showed within our group that people were happy to fulfill those things, whether it be a cup of sugar or some happy birthday balloons, that people realize, oh, well, people actually are willing to share their abundance with me. And in the meantime, I'm getting to know my neighbors and building a community that grows upon itself.
And as I understand it, when you're in the Facebook group, you can make 3 different types of posts, an ask, receive, and also a gratitude post too. James, can you talk about that third one, the gratitude post, and what that's all about?
Yeah, of course. It's sometimes one of my favorite ones, to be honest with you, because I think, you know, as Sarah mentioned, this group operates a little differently than most, and part of it really is around building community with those that you live around. And so in the group, we encourage people to express gratitude towards other people in the group, you know, publicly, you know, partly because it reinforces the idea Sarah was just mentioning, you know, that we all have something we can give and we all have something we could get from the group. And we should also, you know, be happy about it. And it's often those posts that get a lot of people chiming in that then are spurred to add on gratitude, sometimes to the person that, you know, the original post was thanking, and sometimes, you know, that it just inspires them to thank other people where they've really given second lives or multiple lives to things from other people in the group that they maybe wouldn't have had otherwise or have had to pay for, and just are pretty happy that they didn't have to do so.
Sarah, earlier you mentioned adult bikes on the Facebook group, and I'd imagine that if one person is offering a bike and the other person shows up to get one, they're both interested in biking, and there may be a connection or perhaps a friendship that arises from that. Have you experienced that in your time in the group?
Yeah, actually, I did just recently. I had a member that met me actually at my garden to come and get some chamomile leaves to use for tea. and she noticed that I had the same compost bin that she had. And she was telling me all about it. And I was like, well, you know, you must have much better luck than I have, because my compost is not doing well. I don't think I'm doing it right. And we were able to connect, and she gave me some tips and tricks as to maybe how to do a better job. And so, yeah, we were able to kind of build a little gardening relationship there.
And James, from what I've heard, you and Sarah started this basically from the ground up in Appleton with not many people in the Facebook group at the beginning. Can you talk about what it took to grow to the several thousand people you have in there now?
Yeah, and I just looked right as we were hopping on here. 1,500 as of today in our group, and about almost 4,000 in the Valley area here in the greater Appleton area, which is great. But yes, to your point, in the early days, no one in the area really knew what it was, probably other than me and Sarah and our, you know, partners, because we told them about it. And so we tried just to put the word out there in any and every way we could. I had no real network, having just moved to the area. So I was trying to find other Facebook groups or places online to just put it out there that it existed. I know Sarah reached out a lot to people in her network. And as I met people, I just pretty frequently, but also, hey, do you live in this area? Do you know about this group? And then tried to, you know, encourage them to join. And honestly, I think, you know, that helped get the ball rolling a little bit. But, you know, it really, I think, to Sarah's point earlier, took us, you know, constantly posting in the group. Sometimes even in those early days, Sarah and I would just post something and say, hey, can you just say you want this, even if you don't, just so people know what it means to use the group, so that people think there's reason to come back and try it out. And honestly, kind of, it just started taking off as people had experiences, I think, that they were compelled to tell people too. And once we got to about 100, it just kind of kept going. And we had, I think, 190 people join in the last 5 weeks. Wow. So, I mean, it's just really kind of taking off a whole lot at this point through word of mouth. Cause I think it feels different in the group than I think most other communities online, especially on Facebook these days.
And Sarah, what are your hopes for the next 6 months, the next maybe 6 years of the Buy Nothing Facebook group? What are you looking forward to in the future?
Well, hopefully I'm not over speaking for James, but I know James and I have talked a little bit about splitting our group. It's called Sprouting. As it grows, what happens with a large online community like that, it gets to be quite a bit for, you know, admins to handle. So we have talked about how and when that will happen, if it will happen at all. We've also talked about possibly bringing on another admin to help us with all of the work that comes with this group now being 1,500 people. But I hope that it continues, and I hope that people begin to utilize some of the lesser known gifts, meaning gifts of time and gifts of service. So for example, you could ask someone to help you move your fridge out of your house, or come pull weeds in your garden, or teach you how to do something. And I really hope to see a lot more of those connections, because sometimes it's those services and those acts of time that really we need from our own community.
Well, Sarah and James, we'll leave it there, but thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you so much.
Sarah Scanlon is an environmental health specialist for the state of Wisconsin. James Bacon, an educational technology business owner. They talked with us about the Appleton Buy Nothing Facebook group, which they started together. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary-Kate McCoy with a story about the power of preparing a good meal.
Writer Crystal Chan loves to cook. During the pandemic, she traveled home often, enjoying long stays with her parents. To show her gratitude, she would cook delicious and comforting dishes for family dinner. She shares a story celebrating the labor of love that goes into making a great pot of stew.
A little while ago, when I was visiting my parents in Wisconsin, I found an old cookbook that I had purchased in France. I've been visiting my parents as an extended guest throughout COVID, journeying back and forth between Oshkosh and Chicago. Gratefully, my parents welcomed my ping-ponging across the state line with open arms. Come, stay as long as you'd like. Leave whenever you wish. I love cooking, and I quickly found that making home-cooked meals for my parents elicited oohs and ahs, and my stepdad's famous understated way of declaring that he loved a dish. He would say, "I could eat that again." Cooking was a very excellent way to express my gratitude. So, I took that French cookbook and found a recipe for beef bourguignon. The next day, I made the pot of deep simmering broth, rich chunks of beef and vegetables and wine. My parents exclaimed how I was filling up the whole house with such rich smells. There is something indeed really special about filling up the house with a loving smell of simmering food. I am a foodie for sure, and I have found that it's a very sensual way of taking up all the space in the house. You put love into a pot, add a gentle flame, and then surrender to the process of transformation. And somehow, it fills up the whole house, this energetic field of nourishment and love of which I am a critical part. I love the meditation of cooking. You transform one thing into another. You take multiple ingredients, and somehow they turn into a unity that perhaps an onion and a carrot could not have otherwise imagined. Then, if you are lucky, you can share such love food with beloveds, and the deep aromas of stews that will linger in the house long after the meal is over. That's how love works. This resonance gently permeates so that the moment you open the front door, it greets you. Love, savory and nourishing, caressing you all, both unseen and everywhere. After hours of simmering, I declared that the meal was ready. My stepdad had set the table hours before in his wordless display of anticipation, so I poured the glasses of wine, reverently placed the food on the plates, and granted them to my parents with a flourish. To our stunned delight, my stepdad took his time eating. Usually, he inhales his food. Now he savored it, feeling the flavors in his mouth, tasting the thyme and the deep love it rested upon. My mom excitedly asked me questions about the recipe, the process. I told her what I could about the recipe, but the process? That's harder because it includes unnameable steps. Feeling into the timing of the food, knowing the exact moment the next step needs to begin, and infusing the recipe with love. Finally, as we sat back in our chairs, hands on our contented stomachs, my stepdad looked at me with sparkling eyes and said in his ritual exclamation, "I could eat that again."
Writer Crystal Chan brought you that story about the power of preparing a good meal. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, a Wisconsin woman is attempting to be the youngest person to circumnavigate the globe on a motorcycle. We'll check in as she gets ready to hit the road. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Knetter, in for Rob Ferret. A Wisconsin woman is attempting to be the youngest person ever to circumnavigate the globe on a motorcycle. The current record holder is Henry Crew, who finished the journey at age 23. But Bridget McCutcheon, age 21 of Sanborn, Wisconsin, may break that record as soon as next year after she begins her journey this August. And she's with us right now. Bridget, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, thank you. It's nice to be here.
Great to have you with us. And Bridget, I got to start. What led you to decide to attempt this journey and go after this record?
Well, it was sort of a family inspiration, I suppose you'd say. My oldest brother came to me with this idea. He is also an avid motorcyclist. He was like, you know, at the time I was 20. And he said, you know, you're 20, you could totally do this. And I was like, no. And then I kind of, you know, switched gears a little bit. And I'm like, well, yeah, I could do that. So that's kind of where it started.
And I think a lot of people want to travel the world at some point in their lives. Not too many of them want to do it on a motorcycle. What is special to you about doing this on a bike?
So I love motorcycles. I think they are the coolest thing since sliced bread. But, oh, sorry.
Well, so, we're talking with Bridget McCutcheon right now of Sanborn, Wisconsin. A little bit of a car horn right there. We'll give a minute for that to quiet down. She's attempting to become the youngest person in the world to circumnavigate the globe on a motorcycle, leaving on her journey this August. And we're talking with her right now about getting ready for that trip. Bridget, are you still with us? And have things calmed down there?
I am.
Great.
The car has dissolved itself. Anyway, why I chose the motorcycle. When I am on a motorcycle and I am riding, I am much more engaged than I am in a car. Everything that is happening around me is happening to me. And sometimes, you know, it's not so fun. Sometimes it rains on you. So that's fine. But it's much easier for me to explore new places on a motorcycle because I feel like it's, you know, when you're in a car, you're moving through the world in a bubble. When you're on a motorcycle, you're moving through the world almost in the same way that you would be walking down a forest trail. And that's, it's very exposing to me, and I really like that.
Now, Bridget, when I first heard about your endeavor, I admit oceans came to mind right away. And I think that might be the case for a lot of people. Can you talk us through the route you're going to take and doing what it takes to qualify for this record?
So I will be going down. I will be going to the West Coast, and I will be going down the western side of America and pretty much sticking with that theme all the way down through Central America and then South America until I get all the way to Uruguay, which is the very, very tip of the world. And I will come back up through Argentina and then Brazil until I intend on flying my bike. I can ship it, but shipping takes much longer. And one of the requirements for the record is that I cannot stay anywhere for more than 2 weeks unless it's for some extreme medical reason. So I'm going to fly my bike, which is very expensive. I will fly it to the UK, and then I intend to go to Ireland, come back to the UK, go to France, go to sort of across Europe. And that's pretty much where certainty ends. Because of the tumultuous nature of the world at the moment, that's pretty much as far as my plan has gone solidly.
And are you anticipating perhaps some uncertainty or some challenges beyond Europe?
Yes. So my biggest concern pretty much with this whole trip is being able to get through those countries. So there's three countries that you would have to go through to get to the other side of Asia, which are Russia, China, or Iran. And all of those countries require visas from American citizens, and all of those countries are very difficult to get through for American citizens. Like right now, China is super locked down. Pretty much not even an option. Russia is closed, but only sort of. It's very strange. Iran, you can't go overland through it at the moment. But again, that's not set in stone. There's all these things that the government says, and then there's what's actually happening. So hopefully I will be able to make it through one of those countries and make it to either Vladivostok, South Korea, or Vietnam. And from one of those three places, I will fly hopefully to Canada and then back home to the U.S.
Wow. So those are the challenges. But Bridget, I'm wondering, aside from the record itself, what are you most looking forward to on the trip?
I am so excited to just see the world. I've never officially left the country. And I've mostly, except for the last year, stayed in my bubble of almost pretty much Wisconsin. And I am just so thrilled to see the world. And that sort of, that started when I went to Washington and I worked on a very large tall ship called the Lady Washington. And that sort of opened my eyes to the world is here and there's no reason for me not to see it, especially at this point in my life.
Wow. Well, Bridget, before we run out of time, I'm curious about the gear you have to take. I imagine you have to pack pretty light, but what are you taking along with you?
So I have some few essentials. I have like inner tubes, an air compressor, but I was just sponsored by Moscow Moto, which is a motorcycle gear company, and they gave me this wonderful set of rackless bags, and that'll hold all of my stuff, along with I've also been sponsored by Aerostitch, which is a really good motorcycle suit company. So I have all the safety gear I need. I have everything I need to hold my stuff. But as far as actual physical things I'm taking, it's pretty much the standard camping gear, repair kit for the gut bike. I have a GPS tracker, which you can find on my website, 2-wheels-around.com. But pretty much other than that, it's pretty basic.
Gotcha. Well, this is exciting. Bridget, best of luck on your trip, and hopefully we get a chance to talk to you when you return.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. That was Bridget McCutcheon attempting to be the youngest person ever to circumnavigate the globe on a motorcycle. You can follow her travels on her website, Bike Wheel Travel. That's linked at wpr.org/centraltime. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, humans have designed a lot of things to keep water in check and out of the way. But a changing climate may demand a new approach. We'll talk with the author of the book, Water Always Wins. Plus, the relationship between being stressed and being sick. We'll talk with a Wisconsin researcher tomorrow on Central Time.